dwelling in the darkest depths of the mind, it's time for Mark D. Valenti and Brain Burrow.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark D. Valenti, and this is Brain Burrow. This is one of our digging deep sessions where we have an opportunity to really dig deep with our guests and an opportunity for them to share about their perspective, their values, their fears, what they want to do with their lives and what their motivations might be. So I'm very pleased to talk a bit this evening with one of my co-actors who I had a chance to work with, Larry Butler, and I'm going to hand it over to him with the big question, who exactly is Larry Butler?
What a wonderful question. I am a person who never fit in, so he was obligated to stand out. So I jumped the fence in my small town of Calistoga, California, up in the Napa Valley, and came to the big city looking for fame and fortune, I guess, like many younger people, except that I became an actor at 35. And before that, I traveled the world in the Navy and then I settled in Colorado. But to answer your question, I was tormented so much in grade school and high school that I was not comfortable in my own skin. So I created all these imaginary characters, a lot like Jim Carrey, and did a lot of comedy. And when I became an actor, excuse me, my voice is going already, too much screaming on set. When I became an actor, I did horrible comedy, and then I got into horror comedy. And then finally someone saw the real dark side of me, because I'm very transparent with my emotions, and started casting me in horror. And then I actually got to do a little drama as well, which I really adore. But it's hard to do because you get typecast and it's hard to get out. But going back to my childhood, I had a very strict mother, and wasn't very fond of me, apparently. And so I kind of absorbed her criticism of myself, and I can be quite neurotic at times. And the reason I stay in acting is I love to tell the story, but I also love to wear, you know, different people's personalities. I like to be different people other than myself. I used to tell people I'm vanilla and I want to be all the other flavors, you know, in the ice cream parlor. But that's not totally true, because I do have a sense of humor and a perspective. I actually wanted to study myself so much that I went through almost a master's program in psychology. I got a BA in psychology and one in sociology, and then went on for a master's in social psychology. But this was the 70s, the early 70s. Nobody knew what to do with me. So they hadn't melded the two yet. So I was just left to my own devices, and I quit my master's program halfway through after 16 years of college or school. And so I went to Denver, Colorado, and drove a forklift with my education. So I'm a series of contradictions, and that's pretty much who I am. I don't even know myself, but I do know that I have two wells of pain and sorrow and tragedy, and I dip into them quite frequently, and I cry instantaneously. I'm one of the few men that can do it. And it's like, cry, okay. And then it's like, too much, stop. You know, it's like an overwhelming response. But I also have wells of joy, and I'm one of the few actors who isn't emotionally constipated. I can give you real emotion, like a lot don't. They fake it, they act. You can see the strings, and I don't. I taught acting for many years, and I told my students, don't fake it, feel it. But it's really hard to do for a lot of people. And I say you're cheating your audience, because they come to theaters for a vicarious thrill. They themselves are emotionally constipated and expect you to do it for them. And so they're going to pull back if you don't deliver authenticity. And so I always do. I'm a method actor. But I just don't take it home and scare my family. It's all on the set. So I don't know if I strayed too much from your question, but I'm a bit complicated. I overreact sometimes, not in the set, but in real life, because I have PTSD from Vietnam, and I've had a lot of hard times, you know, in the 70s, drugs and alcohol. But I got through all of that. I actually didn't cure my alcoholism, but because you're not supposed to say that. But I was kicked out of AA for bringing a pamphlet saying, you too can be a social drinker. So they didn't really like that. And I said, well, you need me more than I need you, so goodbye. And I thought they were a cult at the time. So, but I cured it through, not cured it, but I arrested it. And it went into remission because of probiotics. A lot of people are not aware of it. I'm not preaching this now, so it's just up to the individual. But probiotics helped me stop my alcohol. Because in your lower colon, you have a lot of things called thrush, and they require alcohol and sugar, especially in the Irish and the Native American community. And so when I stuck to probiotics at very strong doses, it just arrested the whole thing, and I don't require it. I don't crave any of it. Once in a while, I have a social drink, but I don't. People invite me to parties after a set, and I said, no, I'm not interested. There's no need for it. I just want to go home to my family. So I'm kind of a family man at this late stage. I got married at 56 after years of bachelorhood. You know, I never married before. They never wanted to. So my wife kind of helped me through my diabetes, through, you know, my alcohol abuse and sugar abuse. And so now I'm doing okay with it. It goes up and down, you know, but I won't take the medicine. I just completely don't need their medicine. So I take, I teach fitness classes, and I climb mountains, and I'm pretty physically fit. I've lost 65 pounds. And so it's diet, exercise, and just avoiding sugar. And I take a lot of vitamins too. Nutraceuticals are called. And so that helps me. So anyway, I'm probably all over the place right now.
No. It's okay, Larry. And again, it's all but, you know, you how you answer that initial question, and it's there's no right or wrong answer. But what you've really done is given me a lot to think about, and you know how complicated, wonderfully complicated and complex Larry Butler truly is, and so much to talk about. One of the things that I think is most notable to me, and knowing you and working with you, and again, you know, I was privileged to be able to work with you in some scenes when we were on set there, and you know, and I really your professionalism stood out to me, your ability to navigate through ambiguous situations, and in spite of you self-admitting that you struggle sometimes with confidence, or I think you said neurosis and just sort of that behavior, I still hear a lot of Larry Butler being confident in situations, teaching classes, asserting himself. So where does that confidence come from, Larry, given kind of some of the negative experiences you've had?
Boy, that's an excellent question. I think from my father, possibly. He was a little stronger than my mother. She was mercurial, you know, very temperamental. He was more stable. He had a kind of a narrow scope. He was a meat cutter. That was his whole life. He was married to the business, but he was, you know, my rock. But he died at 16. I'm sorry. He died when I was 16, and so that kind of upset my balance, and so I got into drugs right after that. It was the 60s, you know, and so and then alcohol even before that, and so it just kind of threw me for a loop. But And what was your question initially on that?
Yeah, it's okay. It was just basically given, again, as you how are you able to harness that confidence?
Well, I've always been very determined, even though I didn't have a lot of confidence. In fact, people tell me, no, you can't do something. They told me I couldn't be in a marathon because I was too fat. And I was 240 pounds, it's 5'10". And I did it. It took me 9.5 hours, but I did it. And then the next year I did it again in the rain. And so somebody said, well, you'll never climb Mount Whitney because, you know, that's a tall mountain. It's the tallest mountain in the United States other than Denali. And I did it. And no training, fat. I just went up, didn't have a heart attack, didn't pass out. And then I went over, they said, well, you'll never climb Kilimanjaro. That's 19,000 feet. I did it. I just went over there a couple years ago and did it, to summit it. And so the lights went on. Anyway, I'm a very determined person. If you tell me I can't do something, I'll prove you wrong. And I think that happened to me when I was probably 21 years old. Somebody, I was telling everybody, and my mother never, she always thought that I would be least likely to succeed at anything. And the person that I was with, we were both tripping at the time. He said, well, can't you prove her wrong? I thought, wow, that's a brilliant idea. I will. And so I retired from the Navy, which he never thought I'd do, 22 years. I retired as a teacher, 22 years. So I have two retirements. And so she was proud of me when she died at 90. And so finally, you know, I got the validation that I needed from her. And wow. So that's one thing I do have in my favor. You know, and I used to run, and I hated running, and I just kept saying, I can, and I will, I can, and I, the mantra, you know. And so I'm that way with anything. Just tell me I can't do something, and I'll prove you wrong. And so show business career. So my agent in Colorado said, you'll never make it. Larry, you're not slick enough in Hollywood. Here I am, 220 movies later. So wow. Keep plugging away, but anyway, I used to hustle. Now I don't hustle as much, but you know, I'm a little more mellow about it. But I just love people to tell me that I can't do something.
Well, that's that's incredible, Larry, the amount of different achievements that you've been able to accomplish. And I guess the question I have for you then, when is it enough? When do you feel satisfied with what you've accomplished?
Now it's more of a joy than a challenge. It's not like I'm out to prove something, like how many movies can I get under my belt. It's just I enjoy doing it. It's a great hobby. But I skydived for many years, and I think I told you on the set about this. I don't mind saying it because I've been around people. I'm not going to say who. I'm not going to personalize it, but people have committed suicide in my life. And I, too, had a very dark, deep depression at one time. I won't say I was suicidal, but, I mean, it was really a very strong urge to quit this life. And so every time I would think like that, I would go make a skydive. And then at the end of the skydive, I thought, I cheated death. And so I kept doing it over 30 years, and I made over 200 skydives for probably all the wrong reasons. But I didn't enjoy it that much. I learned to enjoy it later when I got better at it, but not in the beginning. And like every skydive was like terrifying, you know, the first 15 or 20 especially. But after that, it became kind of an enjoyable hobby that I do every 3 months or so. I wasn't out there like every weekend, but it was a good way. I'd recommend it to anybody who, no, maybe I shouldn't say that, I'm sorry, because some people will take it all away. But if you're ever depressed, and you know, it's a good way to embrace life and appreciate it more. And in fact, I'm going out with 15 guys from Clown Motel 2 in the next month, and nobody skydived except for me. So I'm gonna help, you know, chaperone them into the plane and hold their hands and so they don't, you know, pass out.
Literally hold their hands, I guess.
And I used to climb mountains too. I mean, they call it free solo now without ropes. Free climbing.
Oh, wow.
And I got a lot of tough spots because I was alone. I scuba dived alone, which is not recommended. I got in some difficult situations there. And all my life, it was risky behavior. And people say, you have a suicidal tendency. So I said, no, it's not really that, but it could be tinged with that. But I'm not out to kill myself. I just want to live on the edge so that I can appreciate life all the better. And I tell my daughter, it's not what you do, it's how you do it. When I skydived, I'd open higher up than most skydivers. Some of them would they call it smoking it in. They come right down to 2,000 feet. Well, if something goes wrong, you're screwed. So I'd open at 3,000. So a couple times I had to jettison my parachute and go for the secondary parachute. And so it helps, you know. And I would not just jump from ledge to ledge. I would, you know, when I was mountain climbing, I would go carefully. I got in some tough spots, but I always figured a way out. But it was stupid to go alone. I admit that. So anyway, so I've kind of had a solitary life. I do have friends, but a lot of them are intellectuals. And so they're either intellectual and they don't do anything athletic, or they're all jocks and they don't do anything intellectual. Rarely do you find somebody that can do both. So I travel in different circles. So, but one overwhelming thing that I have is an overwhelming sense of curiosity. I'm very inquisitive. I think that's why I took all the drugs also, because I wanted to experience, you know, what other people were feeling. I traveled the world as well, because I wanted to see other cultures, other customs. And when I was in the Navy, instead of going to a sailor bar, I'd take a train ride. Like if I was in Korea or somewhere, I would go to different parts and different cities and experience life as the Koreans knew it. I'd study the language, I'd study the coinage, so I'd know, you know, how to use the money. And I still do that with my family. We go to Europe, we go to Central America, South America. I went to Africa and just about everywhere. I've been to over 50 countries, but I just have this overwhelming sense of wanting to experience the world and almost every aspect of it without killing myself, because then it's over. So I'm really not suicidal.
Right. So, yeah, I think that's a great example. Everything you listed is a way to experience life, truly experience life to its fullest, to use that cliche. So where do you think that curiosity comes from? Because it's not just, all right, I'm curious about, you know, maybe, you know, getting this diet soda versus another one. You're talking about some pretty intense things and investing of time and money, and you're bringing your family along. Where's that curiosity come from?
All I can say is when I was 4 years old and my mother was giving me a hard time, I jumped the fence, went out of town a couple miles. There were some hobos. We called them hobos then. Now they're homeless, I guess. But I mean, these guys were tramps. They would tramp around the country. And they were eating lunch down in this ravine. And so I went down there and they were feeding me lunch. And it was the more innocent times. You know, they weren't going to molest me or anything. And then the chief of police drives up on the highway. He goes, "Larry, I think it's time to come home now." He says, "Hello, gentlemen." And, you know, in a polite way, but get the kid out of there. And so he takes me home to my mother, and she starts screaming at me. He says, "Lolita, I don't think you should do that anymore." This kid,
oh my God,
fences. So I jump figurative and literal. You know, I'm a fence jumper, and I've always had that within me. I don't know where it comes from, but this need to explore. And once I was left in Santa Rosa, which is about 20 miles from Calistoga in the Northern California, my sister left me in the dentist's office. She went out the rear door and I was in the lobby, and I tried to find my way home. I ended up like 7 miles out of town in the middle of the highway on the white line. And cars are honking at me, and I probably would have been killed eventually. But this old man in a country store saw me out there and pulled me in. I was probably around 5 years old, and then called the police. And it was on the radio and the news, and they're all looking for me. And so I survived that way. But I just had this sense that I've got to go home because he left me here, and my mother was so frantic and everything. So one time she did, you know, scream at me. So, but anyway, I don't know where it comes from. It's just, I need to, it's the Viking instinct, because I come from Norman stock, you know, from through Norway and to Normandy and then over to Ireland, through England with William the Conqueror and all of that. And so I'm a butler, a bottler. So we bottle wine. So anyway, that's a long story, but.
No, it's in your blood.
This incessant need to, you know, go around the bend and see one more bend in the river, you know,
right,
never content. So,
yeah, And I think, you know, again, thank you for sharing that specifically, because again, you've led an exciting and intense life. And I guess I go back to my other question then. So when is it enough? When does Larry rest?
When I'm dead. Oh, yeah. So I'll have that on my tombstone, you know. He finally rests.
It's a great thing to put on there, that's for sure.
Anyway, I'm always joking about what I'm going to put on my tombstone. Just jokingly, I don't know. Maybe I won't have one.
Well, and I think, you know, your sense of humor, you know, not only today, but also again, working with you, especially in situations that, you know, could be stressful. How did you learn how to hone that sense of humor?
Well, when I was in grammar school, there was a group of four of us, and out of those four people, I'm the only one that pursued acting. We used to perform skits, some improvised, some written, and you know, by each one of us, and then performed by the group. I'd write one for the class and perform it in front of the whole class. I was very creative that way, and but oddly enough, I didn't pursue acting. In high school, I was painfully shy. I had some kind of a switch that flipped off. I don't know why. I became painfully shy, and I used to be very outgoing, and I would be more of a leader. And then I became not a follower necessarily, because I'd follow my own footsteps, but I just pulled back from people. So I didn't do the school play in high school. I didn't do it in college. I did go out for one audition, and they said I got the part, and I was too scared to even show up. So I said, well, then when I became an actor at 35, I said, I'll never do that again. When I have an audition, I'm going to do it. So I've been to every audition since then. But that was a little embarrassing, because they were trying to find me, and they got the part. I don't want the part. I was too scared to perform, you know, theater, you know, live. And I have some stories about that, my first experiences in doing theater. But anyway, it's a short show, so I won't bore you with that. But
It's not boring. It's just you can decide, and some guests are going to come back for part two. So it's up to you what you wanted to talk about. So it's up to you if you want to talk about that, or if you want to talk about why at age 35 you decided to finally jump that fence to kind of pursue that.
yeah,
Either. So
that's a
which.
very interesting story. I was working in a salvage yard for Ma Bell Telephone, as you know, a Mountain Bell Telephone, and it's a very dirty job. Because you're in the dirt, you're salvaging phone parts and putting them in huge piles. People from all over the world, and especially Korea, would come and buy them. Because when you tear a phone apart, in those days there were huge phones back in the early 80s, they would take the silver out, the gold out, the titanium, you know, different things, and put them in separate piles. They come and bid on them, and then buy them and put them in boxcars, you know, in trucks, and then ship them home. And so I was on a forklift getting grimy, had a beard, my fingers were black, and but I had this weird sense of humor, probably even more than I do now. And people said, "My God, you're so funny. You got to get an agent." And I thought, "What's an agent?" You know, I was so green, I didn't even know what an agent was. They said, "Well, we'll call them for you. We'll get you an audition." So I went over, and the woman literally climbed the chair to get away from me. She's like, "Jesus Christ, this guy's crazy. He's like a homeless person." And so then I learned how to, you know, clean up. They taught me how to, you know, walk without dragging my knuckles on the floor, and how to eat with knife and fork. And they trimmed my beard, taught me how to dress. I mean, some of this is true. Color coordinate, because I wear a yellow with green pants and a red jacket, and you know, people are like, "No, wrong. Let's tell you, we'll start with the socks and work up." God.
So you may have needed a little bit of help there.
I did need help in that department. But then, as soon as I went to this agent called JF Images. She used to be an international model. And then in those days, you could have a school and an agency. It wasn't illegal like it is now. You got to separate them. So once you passed the school, and she was the final audition, and she was called the Dragon Lady, and I was scared of her. Everybody was. So I muffed the first audition. I said, "Could I have a moment? You know, just give me one more." She said, "Okay, I'll give you one more chance." She's staring daggers at me, and I was flawless the second read. So she said, "Okay, we're going to sign you." And so after that, I started booking like crazy. First commercials, then TV shows, and Denver is not a lot. I did work for Perry Mason, the original Perry Mason, and some Father Dowling shows in Denver, and not many movies up there. But one movie came to town called The Women's Club, Warner Brothers. And so I got cast in the biggest role anybody had ever gotten in Denver. And so I worked with Maude Adams from Octopussy, Eddie Velez from A-Team, Michael Paré from Streets of Fire, Eddie and the Cruisers. And so I co-starred with them. And the strength of that, I came to Hollywood. And in end of 88, early 89, I was here. And then I got lucky. I got a good agent right on Hollywood Boulevard called Film Artist. Had Peter Graves and several other actors, were with him. And so then I went on my first audition in Hollywood, and the woman, the casting director, called my agent. She says, "We want Larry on Friday." He says, "Oh, you mean for a callback?" I said, "No, we want him." So I laughed like that.
Wow.
I was so flummoxed, and bewildered, and kind of upset, and I didn't know where I was. I was late, and I can't find parking. Everybody was cutting me off. I'm like, what kind of a town is this? And I was so frazzled. They said, "You're perfect." So I got a commercial, a national, just like that. Wow. So that's happened several times, because I come in there, like the other day I did a Minnie Cooper commercial, and I was so angry because some idiot cut me off right before I got there, almost hit me. So I went in there like angry, and they looked at me and they shook their head. I got that one. So it's playing Europe right now. This many, it's about a guy at a newsstand. This guy comes and tries to ask him a question. I just give him this look, but it's so evil that they had to do it 12 times. He said, "Larry, you're scaring the shit out of a cameraman. So you can't hold the camera steady. This isn't a horror movie. You're just indifferent. You don't hate. You don't want to eat him."
Right. Yeah, just play it as indifferent, not, like you want to kill him, basically.
That's a horror movie.
Right. You can't get it out of your blood, apparently. So. That's incredible, right? Because it actually goes back to what you said, right, about being that authentic self. And I also just, the question I have for you then is, to share one's vulnerabilities, to share one's authentic self, to share one's emotions. I mean, that takes a lot of courage in a way, because you're putting down barriers. So how are you able to do that? Because not, like you said, a lot of people don't do that. So how are you able to muster that sense of, again, vulnerability to share those emotions like that?
That again is a very good question. I don't know how to answer that other than the fact that I can easily access it. Other people, they think of all things like, my father died, and I had a director once that tried to direct me. He says, "Your father just died." I was speechless. I couldn't even get the words out because it was such a trauma. I mean, that was a mistake on his part. But I don't need any help from a director. It's just there. So up. And it's so in tune with my emotions that you say, okay, cry or be traumatized. It's like, Jesus Christ! Oh, God! Yeah. Start crying. And I did this recently. You weren't there because you left the next day. You don't know what happened to me, because they were going to cut all my remaining scenes. And I was so frustrated and so angry and tired because I wasn't sleeping well, that I finally got somebody to listen to me and said, I think it was Sean Phillips, and I said, "Can we go out back and I just improvise a scene? Because I came all this way 5 days and only two scenes out of eight." And so they said, "Okay, come on. So you're looking for your granddaughter." And so I'm looking for Chalet, right? I started improvising a scene, just talking, and I say, there's no one left. And as soon as I said that, I thought of all the people that have died in my life, all my parents, my sisters, my nieces and nephews, and I've had one tragedy after another. And I started bawling like a baby. And I thought, I'm not shutting this off. I'm going to use it. So I just continue a stream, and they filmed me like five different takes, continually crying, screaming for her. Where are you? And I'm not going to spoil the movie for you, but you got to see it. But worked out. They said that was an Academy Award performance, what you just did.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then there was a guy that showed up out of nowhere and they used him. And I said, I want you to reach out and like a false, like in a monster movie, there's always something that reaches out that's a human, right? And it kind of a false scare. And I scared the shit out of him because he PTSD, and I went, Jesus Christ, what the hell are you doing? And he just, and it was so real because it was just, that's who I am. I can't fake anything. It's got to be real. And just, you know, I just almost gave us both a heart attack. So hopefully they keep it in because I don't know. They did. No, I think the hell they had. And Will Colazzo, the producer of that, finally contacted me. He says, I'm going to give you this real juicy part in the next movie. And I thanked him for it. And that was really nice of him to do that. Because he says, I know what you can do. And I know you're going to crush this one. And so I became a goofy guy. Because I used to be goofy back in my younger days when I was doing comedic bits. So I way over the top. But that's what it needed. Because it's a horror film, a slasher movie. And you need to balance it out. A little levity.
That's right.
You know. And so I gave him that. And everybody was laughing, like maybe even unintentionally, you know. Even the guy behind the camera was like, he had to turn his head. He couldn't even walk right. But I give everything I can.
No, I mean, that's clear. I mean, you definitely do. And again, even the short time that we worked together, that was clear that you were your authentic self and bringing that every day.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things I remembered now on my tombstone. He gave memorable performances in many forgettable movies. So, because you know that's the ego part of it. I want to be remembered. So I want to be the one person they remember out of that whole forgettable film. Even if it's a horrible film, I have to get a sterling performance. And so I'll settle for that. I don't need fame. Well, once in a while, someone goes, I know you from somewhere. You know, that's good for me, you know. They don't chase me down the street for an autograph, but they know you from something. And like, oh, sure. Check out the IMDb, and maybe you spot it. But so anyway, it's just that makes me happy because when I was a kid, you know, I never fit in, so I have to stand out. And so I didn't come up with that, but I borrowed it from somebody. I thought that's a perfect phrase. So people who don't fit in have to stand out.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I was going to say that seems to define a lot of your actions through your life, and you embrace it, and I think that says a lot about you. So what advice would you give the listeners or viewers out there who just heard you talk, who heard you talk about a lot of interesting things about your life, the way you've navigated things, the way you've made the best out of situations, the way you've embraced some difficult situations. What advice would you give somebody else out there who's maybe listening in?
I would say embrace life. It's live it to the fullest because it's very short. You know, I'm almost 72. So it's gone like... So I'm glad I did all the things I did. And some people even tried to stop me from doing things like, no, you know, I'm not going to kill myself, but... You know, I'll come to the edge and look over. I'm not going to fall over. So, but I like coming up to the line and putting my nose over. You know, but I know my limits and I'm careful at the same time. So I just enjoy life. I mean, and don't let other people get you down. They don't have the power they think they do. You have the power. So use it. Don't allow people to affect you. So I always rejected the rejectors. Early on, I remember that of doing that, saying, they don't know what they're talking about. I know what's good for me, and I know what I'm capable of, and I'm not all those things they say I am. And so I lived my life accordingly. I lived kind of alone. I was kind of a loner for a long time, but still, I enjoyed my own company, you know. Like Peter Ustinov used to say... you know, you're imprisoned in your own mind. You might as well be comfortable. So, you know, I have all these memories to reflect on.
Yeah, that's great advice, Larry. And actually a perfect way to end this segment, because again, I think Very well said. Now you've lived that life, and I commend you for that.
Thank you.
So I want to thank you. Yeah, I want to thank you for sharing your experiences today. It was very insightful.
And thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me on. Yeah.
You're great. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, no problem. And I want to thank, of course, the listeners and viewers out there who tuned in to Brain Burrow today. And on behalf of Larry Butler, this is Mark DiValenti signing off for Brain Burrow. Have an amazing rest of your day.
See you on the set.
You just dug deep with Mark D. Do you want more? Follow Mark on Instagram at ValentiHorror and subscribe to the Brain Burrow podcast.